What's up, guys? Welcome back to the RCT Network. And first things first, if you haven't gone and subscribed to the YouTube channel at RCT Network, then go do it, because you can watch all the video clips of the podcast and other video content that I put up on the channel. We're trying to grow the channel, trying to grow the audience. Again, if you like this podcast, subscribe to the podcast, share the podcast. We got a real good message, a lot of interesting things that we discuss. And I try to think that my views are somewhat unique, at least to myself. You know, I know a lot of people share the same values, same ideas that I do. And I just try to explain it in a different way, from a different perspective. Now, today, I got an array of different topics to discuss. But the first thing I want to talk about is I was listening to Patrick Bet-David of Valuetainment. And if you haven't gone and listened to Patrick Bet-David on Valuetainment, I suggest you do. He's a huge podcaster, businessman, right? He's kind of like a Joe Rogan type podcaster, has a bunch of different guests on there. But they do, and this may be a little biased for myself, but they do talk about a lot of things that I agree with. But today, he had a video clip on his podcast, and he made some statements that I truly will think about forever, and it makes a lot of sense. Now, these were not his original statements. This was just his discussion. He got this information out of a book called Toxic Charity by Robert Lupton. And the video starts off with him claiming, with Patrick claiming, that the good things to run a political campaign on in today's world, such as the elimination or reduction of entitlement programs, are impossible to win on. And then he goes and he starts quoting the book, Toxic Charity, and he gives you the five phases of toxic charity. The first phase of toxic charity is appreciation. If you give something to someone one time, they're going to be appreciative of it. Or if you receive something one time, you're appreciative of it. Hey, thank you for giving me that. If you give to someone two times for the second stage, it creates anticipation. And now that person on the receiving end starts to anticipate whether or not you will actually give them something again in the future. Then you move on to the third stage. And when you give something to someone three times, when you give charity three times, now they form what is called expectation. And now they will be expecting it from you. On the fourth stage, you give to someone four times, and now you have created entitlement. The fourth stage is entitlement. And on the fifth stage, when you establish a dependency after giving to someone more than four times and thereon afterwards, they form a dependency. And if you stop the charity, then they become your enemy. They hate you for it. Hey, why are you not giving this to me? Why have you stopped giving? Think of it like this. You go to a national park and or wherever. You go to the beach, right? And you see signs, don't feed the birds, don't feed the animals. Why? Because animals, when you're feeding them, they grow dependent. Or they grow an expectation that you're going to give it to them. And when you don't give it to them, what happens? They attack you. It ends up not working out. Like bears, right? They're looking for food. If people are feeding the bears, what are they going to do? They're going to start coming to campsites all the time looking for that food. And if you don't have it, you're the food now. It's the same way with people. And we've created a society, especially in the United States, but in the Western world in general, where we have a very dependent civilization. Not everybody, but a lot of people. And I bring this up because right now, and I just got the message, the House passed the resolution to increase the debt ceiling, which you knew was going to happen. However, in the bill, the provisions to cut spending by $1.5 trillion over the next decade. The Republicans wanted to reduce spending because the Democrats have been spending money like crazy. Why? Because they have been wanting to give out these entitlement programs. Another provision was that the Republicans wanted to increase work requirements on those who are receiving entitlements such as food stamps. And I'm listening to the arguments today in the House of Representatives, and the Democrats are all about giving out these entitlements, saying that the Republicans are literally disrupting the lives and the economic standing of people's lives by wanting to reduce these benefits. No, they are not, first of all. Requiring you to work more to receive a benefit, an entitlement from the government is not disrupting your financial life. In fact, it's going to benefit your financial life because you're going to be earning an income. The other thing is, in every bill that has been released by Democrats as of lately, and really going back since the 60s, there have been provisions focused on allocating substantial funds in lower and impoverished communities in order to boost or start new programs designed to reduce things such as what? Crime, violence, homelessness, etc. Yet, as the government spends more and more under the idea that they're going to make a difference, these very things tend to get worse and worse on these communities. Why? Well, for one, the money's really not going to the programs, right? It's someone's getting rich off of this is what it's really happening. Yeah, we're going to give money to some program to curb gun violence in the black communities. Okay, great. Did it work? No, never has. Why? Because it's really not going and being allocated to do what it's ideally supposed to do. And three, the government tends to fail at things like this anyway. And four, when you start, a lot of the money that they've thrown into impoverished communities, and this is white communities too, this isn't just black communities, it's white, it's any impoverished community, it tends to be in the form of an entitlement. And people get dependent on the money coming in these entitlements, and they don't learn how to prosper for themselves. I started reading portions of the book before I got on the podcast of Toxic Charity, again, by Robert Lupton. And in it, he gave six recommendations for those who do charity work. And these 6 points apply to the government just as much as it does any ordinary individual. The first point was never do for the poor what they can do for themselves. If someone can do it for themselves, then don't do it for them. Two is limit one-way giving to emergencies. Three, empower the poor through employment, lending, and investing using grants sparingly to reinforce achievements. And that grant versus loan and lending is something that I think people get confused on. You often hear about all these grants the government's going to give out. A grant is money that is given to something for a reason but does not need to be paid back. A loan is money that is allocated or given to someone for something, right? But it has to be paid back. It's a form of debt. That's why lending to help people is better than giving them grants. Because if you just give them money and they don't need to pay it back, there's no strings attached. Whether or not they fail has, you know, it's irrelevant at that point. If you loan money to someone, though, and you expect it to be paid back, there is an understanding that the money is there for a reason. And, you know, once that reason is accomplished, you will make the person that helped you out whole again. The fourth thing was subordinate self-interest to the needs of those being served. And number five was listen closely to those who you seek to help. And in particular, listen to what is not said to be apparently felt. And six, do no harm. But those first three really got me. And I often think it's just crazy that, and we know why, right? We know why, and it goes both ways. Republicans and Democrats do this because the Republicans, again, going back to what Patrick said, they're going to try and speak a big game on stop giving out these entitlements, but they're going to continue to do so, excuse me, because they know that it's politically so unfavorable to really cut a lot of this stuff out. Then, you know, they don't want to risk potential votes coming in for them. Unfortunately, having a lack of understanding of the financial system, economics, and the burdens it actually places on society as a whole, but also on the individual level, for all people, you know, we don't teach this stuff in school. We don't teach how bad it is that the country is in so much debt. We don't teach, we would never teach, how much of a scam Social Security has been and the burden Social Security has actually had on the United States as a whole. If you did, no one would fund it anymore. It would be eliminated. But now we are in a time where if you were to even phase Social Security out, you would never be elected office. Like if you threw up that idea ever, that's why I could never probably be elected to public office in the United States, because I personally believe, and it is of my values, that Social Security should not exist. It's a form of robbery. It's a scam. And there's better trade-offs that people could do with their money. Far better options. Obviously, people seem to not understand this as a whole. There are people that do, but not as a whole. And I've given the numbers behind this. And so if I came into, you know, trying to be elected for office, throwing out that I want to eliminate Social Security or at least phase it out, I would never win. But I'm watching these arguments in the House of Representatives before they vote to increase the debt ceiling. And what's funny to me is I'm listening to a leftist politician, I can't remember who the name was, where they're from, complain that even if, you know, that even if people found a job to keep receiving the food stamp benefits, that the jobs they would get are not paying high enough wages to support the individual, let alone the individual's family. And I'm sitting here laughing at this because this is the same party that sits here and brags about how we have the lowest unemployment rate ever, and how they have added a record amount of new jobs into the economy, and not just new jobs, but new high-paying jobs into the economy. So then you're going to turn around and argue that these individuals can't find a good-paying job because there are no opportunities, while you just said you added all these opportunities. And then you really want to argue that someone who is receiving food stamps is better off not working and receiving these benefits with no income, or very little, or, you know, they're better off doing that than they would be to go to work with at least a minimum wage job. And I would say you would earn far more than minimum wage these days, and participating in the economy, having an income, and still being able to receive the fucking benefits. I don't know what kind of argument that is. That is the Democratic Party is becoming a pure definition of insanity, right? Let's keep doing the same things over and over again, expecting different results. And over time, over and over again, these welfare initiatives have not just failed, but have actually decreased the value in these impoverished areas. It has literally made them worse over time. And it's not just in these impoverished areas, but it's actually making all of society worse. It's making the population as a whole, and it would be increasing a wealth gap because you're incentivizing people to not work as much. You're taking people out of the workforce, and the people who were never, you know, prone to getting these entitlements, the hardworking individuals who are successful, well, they just keep doing what they're doing. So yeah, you do have a growing gap there, but it has nothing to do with capitalism. It has nothing to do with the free market. It has to do with the, in fact, the opposite, the more socialist side of our economy, the more communist ideology and Marxist ideology that we put out there has actually led to a larger wealth gap. Which brings me to the next thing I want to discuss. And that is the communists and capitalist divide that we are seeing. The United States was founded on the free market. It is the most prosperous and largest economy to have ever existed in the history of the world. There's nothing close. Every country that practices capitalism in a free market is a thriving economy, at least since it has done this. Anyone that has gone from whatever kind of system they had before into a capitalist free market economy is prosperous. The ones that aren't prosperous are the ones who either had capitalism and now have gone socialism, like a Venezuela, or just straight communist countries or a socialist country like China. You could say China's thriving, right? China's thriving for other reasons. But the people in China aren't thriving, and there's plenty of numbers behind this. We look at poor countries, Vietnam. We look at all of the countries in Africa. Guess what? All of them socialist countries. All of them. And it's funny because people who support socialism and communism will say, you don't know what communism is. There's never been a communist country. And, you know, socialism isn't, you know, it's never been done right. It's never been done right. So the problem with communists today is, and the problem with communists forever, is they implement it, it fails. And then the new people say, oh no, they just didn't know what they were doing. And we're going to try it here again. And then it fails. And then on a third attempt, you have new people that come in and say, no, communism works. The last two didn't know how to do it properly. They didn't know what they were doing. We do. They implement it. It fails. And it fails and fails. And it's the definition of insanity. What is that? You do the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result. The reason why communism, and we're going to say socialism, because socialism is just a means on its way to communism. That's all it is, right? It's just a stepping stone towards communism. And the reason it doesn't work is because communism, when we think of communism, we think of equality of outcome. Now, for all you diehard Marxists out there, say that's not what it is. For your definition, it's, you know, a stateless, moneyless, classless society, which is the biggest load of shit that shows that you, if you say that, it shows, one, you don't know what money is used for. Two, you don't know what a state is. And three, you have no perception of what class is. See, communism seeks to eliminate the bourgeois class and hand over control to the proletariat. It doesn't seek to eliminate class as a whole. It seeks to create just one class, and that is the proletariat class. The proletariat class, by the way, are the poor individuals in a country. The bottom end of the, you know, the lower class. That's the proletariats. The bourgeois. And what's funny to me is Marxists seem to not understand this because they act like they've read the Communist Manifesto and other writings of Marx. But the literal definition of bourgeois is the middle class that seeks to participate in capitalism by owning businesses and you know, having private ownership of the means of production. Anyone from the middle class up that seeks to participate in capitalism. That is the literal definition of a bourgeois. So a communist who is true to their beliefs about eliminating the bourgeois class and creating just that one proletariat class is literally telling you that they want everyone that's not in the lower class to be in the lower class, and they want all of society to be in the lower class. And again, it goes back to equality of outcome at that point, because when you hear things like Joe Biden saying, we're going to build the economy from the bottom up in the middle out, to do that, you would have to what? You have to take from the top to allocate resources to the middle and lower class. And guess what? If you're going to take from the top to even out the gap with the middle and lower class, you have to make everyone in the lower class because there aren't enough resources to bring everyone up. You can't bring everybody up and into the middle. You have to bring everybody down and level it out. You bring the lower class up a little bit, but you bring everyone down even further and level it out. And then you have not a 1% wealth gap, not a 10% wealth gap that exists now. You have a 0.01% wealth gap, and everybody else is poor. Everybody. And this is how it plays out in every communist society that's ever existed. Every socialist country, this is how it works. And the funny thing is the idea to the reason behind this, like, why would you want this, is because they think that in a capitalist society that you are being exploited. Capitalists just want to exploit you and extract profits from your labor. Oh my God, how stupid is that? First of all, they're paying you. It's not slave labor. Second of all, you haven't read The Wealth of Nations. Third of all, the countries who have the most exploited labor via by exploited by either capitalist companies or government-owned enterprises in socialist countries, the most exploited labor is in socialist and communist countries. Think about it. Where's all the slave labor or the majority of slave labor in the world? It's in Africa. All of those countries where that is a problem, all of them are socialist communist countries. Look at China. Uses slave labor. Communist country. Vietnam uses slave labor. Communist country. There's no capitalist country where you have this issue. But they argue that it's an issue because they say, oh, no, it's because they're not paying you a high enough wage. They're exploiting you for your labor, right? They are extracting the means of production and controlling the means of production. The funny thing is that in a capitalist system, you have private ownership. Why? Because private ownership allows the people who are good at what they do to focus on what they do, and it allows the people who have a demand for something to allocate capital and resources towards what that demand is freely. With, you know, if I want to buy a car, I'm going to go and buy a car with my money at the car dealership. I don't have to have the government telling me what to do, where to go. You know, I don't need someone telling the car company how to make cars because they know how to make cars. Let them specialize in it. There's reasons why you have management. There's reasons why you have owners of a business. There's reasons why you have investors in the stock market. The other part of the other problem is that we go towards that equality of outcome. We want everyone to have a say, right? Everyone to have a stake in the company. They tried this, by the way, in Zimbabwe, and it absolutely failed. And not only did it fail, other than South Africa, who's right close behind them, they went from having one of the most prosperous economies in the entire world to having the bottom end, one of the worst ever, and continues to be that way. They took ownership away from the European farm owners, all that stuff, all the people that knew how to farm, that knew how to run the economy. They took it away to give it to that lower class and the natives and all that stuff who had no idea how to operate it. By the way, they also gave it to who? Who really got the benefit in Zimbabwe were the people that work in the government, your higher ups. So the idea that we're going to eliminate our ruling, our business owners and the ones that we're basically jealous of is what they are, to benefit the workers and society, what really happens is they take all the resources away from both the upper, middle, and lower class, and the people that are in power are the ones that gain control of all the resources. And they do so under the umbrella of, well, we are the state, we're the designated, you know, officials that are there to manage these assets. Okay, yeah, right. So going back, though, to the equality of outcome, communism also won't work is because everybody is different. everybody has different needs. Everybody has different personalities. Everybody has different perspectives. Everyone has different opinions and ideas. And the reason why a free market country works so much better is because it allows for the free flow of ideas and opinions, and it allows for, you know, these ideas actually to come to life. That's why the United States has invented more things for the good of society than any other country ever in the history of the world. The list goes on and on. Look at Japan. We dropped 2 nuclear bombs on Japan. We left them. We firebombed Tokyo to hell. Millions of people died. In a matter of 20 years, they're on their way to becoming one of the largest economies in the world. Now they are one of the largest economies in the world. Look at South Korea. Look at the difference between North and South Korea. It is night and day. To say that the people in South Korea don't have a better lifestyle than the ones in North Korea, you'd have to be fucking crazy. But people also analyze risk differently. See, we have people in our country now that support the idea of socialism, and they have no perception of risk. They have no want to take risk. You have to take risk to have reward. There is never a such thing as all reward, no risk. There isn't. It does not exist. Now, is risk and reward directly correlated? Most of the time it is. Sometimes it's not. However, risk and how people perceive risk and the willingness to take risk is what separates us in society. It separates us in levels of success, the decisions we make every day. Let me give you an example. Now, I'm not working in finance anymore, so I can actually talk about the exact investments I do. Hey, my perception of risk is different to other investors. You have people that go and they day trade every day, and I don't believe in it. I think it's rigged. It is gambling because there's no way to predict the future. I like to consider myself an investor and not a speculator. However, I'm there to make money. So I like to trade options. Now, most people have this impression that options are a highly risky and speculative form of trading, and it's not. Because I use options for the way options were meant to be used, and that is to enter or exit certain positions or to be a safe form of leverage. I like to buy what is called deep in the money leap call options. And if you don't know what it is, go look it up. I'm not going to explain it right now. But the idea is that I can, because option contracts have what is called time value on them. You have intrinsic and extrinsic value. And every day, regardless of if the option or the shares work in your favor, you lose money due to time decay. What I like to do is I like to buy these deep in the money call options that have very little time decay on them because they're so far in the money. Then again, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, I'll do another episode on this and explain it. But I purchase these call options and I like to buy them for further than a year out. Why? Because I don't want to pay short-term capital gains to the government. And, you know, I do this on positions that I would like to own 100 shares of. But instead of buying 100 shares of the stock today, I'm going to buy this call option with very little time value on it that gives me almost 100 shares of stock of movement on the up and downside, you know, if for the stock. But the option costs a fraction of the price of 100 shares. Instead of buying 100 shares of XYZ stock at $100 a share, I can get the same gains, have the exact same losses, so same risk, same reward as buying 100 shares, but I may pay $50 a share. I may pay $30 a share. So instead of giving $10,000 for 100 shares at $100 a share, I give $3,000 or $5,000, right, whatever the option cost, for the same upward potential and same amount of risk. So my perception is I'm willing to buy the shares I'm willing to say, hey, I'm willing to lose $3,000, $5,000, but I am not willing to allow an option that I have. I'm not going to buy it at the money or out of the money because I don't want to take the risk of time taking value away from me. I don't know which way the stock's going to go. I think it's going to go up because I tend to buy this on good companies. But I'm in it for the long term, and I think that it's going to grow up over the next year. But if it doesn't, I don't want this thing just decaying and becoming worthless. I want it to have some value at the end so that if I want to exercise it and buy the shares, I still have money left on it or whatever, right? It's all about perception of risk. Now, some people will go and they will sell call options, naked calls, which has a huge risk, but they are perception because they know the probabilities of outcomes. They analyze it. They say, there's a 1% chance that I lose $5,000 on this sell of this option, but I'm going to bring in, $250 worth of a premium that time works in their favor. There's a whole thing behind this. What I'm saying is that where there seems to be huge risk for one individual, some people look at it and say the risk really isn't that big because the chances of it happening are quite small. Therefore, the reward that I'm willing to bring in for the potential worst case scenario, I'm okay with it because the worst case scenario is actually not very likely. And there's a far more probable, what's probably going to happen. And that is a small loss or a good gain. What is acceptable to one person is not acceptable to the next. And we base our decisions off of this, and our personalities play into this as well. So communism and socialism seeks to eliminate the risk-taking opportunities of individuals. And it really suppresses some of us because some of us enjoy that risk. I enjoy going and putting my money into something that I think will grow. And I'm okay with taking the loss because I know what the potential benefit is. And I'm going to calculate that out as best as I can. That's going to put me in the best scenario because we all make rational decisions. To me, rational decision is just making decisions based off of all the information that you have available to you. Everybody's different, though, in how they go about this. That is why you have people in a capitalist country who can have private ownership. That's why you have people who go and start businesses and own the business, and you have the employees. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I hate when I do see a lot of these influencers and stuff on TikTok. It's like, if you don't do this, you're a pussy. If you don't go start a business, you're a pussy. If you're not, going and taking out $40 million in debt and leveraging this asset and doing this, you're just going to be a servant to the man and all this stuff. And that's wrong because some people just aren't okay with that. I'm not okay with doing a lot of this stuff. To say that, there is an extreme, right? Some people, like my wife, for one, loves just being a teacher. I remember asking her when we met, we were in college, and I said, what do you want to do? Like, if you weren't going to be a teacher, what do you want to do? And she flat out told me, Michael, I've always wanted to be a teacher, and that's what I want to do. That is my passion. And I said, okay. Is she going to earn a lot of money? No. She doesn't understand the investing part. She knows that there's certain things you got to do, like buying homes and real estate and the importance that it has, but she lets me take care of that. She wants to be a teacher, and that's her passion. That's what makes her happy. There are a lot of people like that. They're okay with going to work, working for someone, having a steady income, supporting their family, getting paid, and guess what? That is okay. But they're not taking the risk that the business owner is. To say that, there's business owners that don't work at all. First of all, every business owner, everyone who has started a business works far more than any employee at the business, or they have worked to a point where they don't have to anymore. And that's every business owner I've ever met has worked double the hours that any of their employees have. Two, they have all of the financial risk. If the business goes out of business, the business owner is the one on the hook. The employee gets fired. Great, go find a new job. The business owner loses all of the money that they had in the business, their livelihood, potential, they're in debt a lot of times. And that's the risk. And you need people to take that risk because you need people to succeed. You need people to fail Because doing so is what actually grows. Having competition is what gains advancement in our economy and our society. The military, competition in the military. I want you to think about this. Why was Europe so far advanced than every other society? Like, why weren't the Native Americans or the Aborigines in Australia running around with firearms when the Europeans came? Why didn't they create some? Because there was no need to. There was no need to. There was no competition. There was no, you know, the Europeans have been fighting each other and killing each other for the last however many thousands of years. Rome falls, and what does it do? Is it creates this power vacuum, and you have war after war after war all up and down that continent. And they're consistently finding new ways to kill each other. But with the increase in military advancement and technology, you get other forms of technology. You also get ways for people to, hey, how can I profit off of this and you know, increase my livelihood? And look at what it's led to. The military has come up with several inventions. NASA, look at NASA, right? I think about all the benefits that NASA has given to us. And where did NASA, the importance of NASA came in was competing with the Soviet Union in the space race, in the Cold War. But guess what? The difference with the United States and the Soviet Union had the government paying for it and controlling all of the production and suppressing new ideas, where the United States was contracting that out to the private sector. And the people building the rockets, the people coming up with all that, all were private individuals. Yeah, you had the people at NASA working for the government, but all the suppliers of that stuff were private entities, and it benefited the U.S. economy. So whereas the USSR was just draining itself dry, spending on this stuff, trying to keep up, the United States was thriving because all of that was actually coming from the private sector, and the private sector was booming based off of this initiative. And it feeds itself. The problem with socialism and communism is they just give. They get nothing in return. But what it does do is with these entitlements, as these entitlements grow, people need to remember that the people who are receiving these entitlements, while it may seem like there's no strings attached, there really is a cost to it. And the cost is an indebtedness to the government by the receiver of the benefits, and a growing indebtedness of the government to those who are providing the means for the government to pay for these welfare systems. Because again, it costs money. And as the government needs more money to pay for these entitlement programs, that means people are giving the government money. And the government is losing leverage over the high powerful individuals who's giving them money, be it corporations or other countries, whoever you may think it is. And the people who are receiving the benefits are getting indebted to the government. And it's a slippery slope. The more entitlements you receive, the less freedom you have. That, no matter what you want to argue about, the more the government gives to you, the less you are able to make your own decisions, because the government's going to come and say, you have to do this, this, and this in order to receive those entitlements. And you are going to feel a dependency for them. And guess what? You're going to stop doing what you want to do and have to cater to whatever the government wants you to do. It's as simple as that. So that is the idea of today's discussion. But, you know, take what I'm saying and really think about this. And if you're one of these people who are supporting a lot of these, this help for people, think about, is it really in their best interest? Is it really in the best interest of people to just give with nothing in return, just because they may need the help? There are people that really need the help that truly just cannot provide for themselves, but that is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people who can provide for themselves, but we're not allowing them to. We're not giving them the opportunity to provide for themselves, because we keep them down actually by just fulfilling their basic needs. You know, here's some Medicaid, here's some food stamps, You know, don't make an income over this amount so you can keep getting it. That's stupid. That is stupid.